Welcome to Snack Break. We speak to experts, mostly about policy, but also about snacks.
Starting with his 2016 presidential campaign, Donald Trump has consistently challenged the prevailing conception of the United States' role in the world. He has encouraged, albeit inconsistently, less engagement abroad, a heavier reliance on others to solve international issues, and a renegotiation of major international agreements. He has also directly criticized the role of diplomacy in foreign affairs, and by neglecting to fill key roles in the administration and partially freezing the matriculation of foreign service officers, he's effectively shrunk the State Department. This is Snack Break. I'm Arun Mukherjee, and here today to discuss the United States' changing role in the world, international law, and issues of foreign policy is Avril Haines, who served in the Office of Treaty Affairs in the State Department in the W. Bush and Obama administrations, and also served as a deputy director of the CIA and the deputy national security advisor to President Obama. Avril, thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So there's been a lot of talk about major changes in foreign policy, and the Trump administration seems pretty hell-bent on changing most orientations of American foreign policy from the previous administration, but I haven't seen a ton of major changes. There's been a lot of talk of them. Is it tough to actually change the direction of the ship, so to speak?
Yeah, it depends on the issue, obviously, but for a lot of things, it's tough to change. And I'd say, you know, some of these issues, as we look at them, it's sort of hard to know how much sticking power they're going to have. So, for example, in the context of the withdrawal from the climate change accord, which was obviously well publicized, the reality is we haven't actually withdrawn from the climate change agreement. There's a provision in it that essentially says that you have to wait 4 years after entry into force before you can withdraw. And the statement that appeared to have gone from the State Department to the depositary indicates it's our intent to withdraw in the future, essentially. So it's, you know, that hasn't changed much yet at this stage. On the other hand, there are a lot of domestic changes that are occurring, and there's an attitude surrounding it, and it's sort of hard to see at this point yet how much that's going to make a difference.
So with something like the climate accord, if within 4 years, say, Trump is replaced and he agrees to step down, both ifs at this point, could another administration just come in and say, actually, I take that back?
Yeah. So there's a couple things, I guess, that we'll have to see how they work out. One thing is that he can actually withdraw before the end of his term. So it is likely, it seems to me, that we would end up in that situation. It is possible that a new administration comes in, a new president decides to rejoin in that scenario. So that's, you know, a possibility. But the other piece of this is whether or not the United States is going to actually comply with, essentially, what we expect for the United States under the climate accord. And there, you know, we'll have to see what the states do, what others do, how it is that we're positioned at that point, and whether or not the next president is actually interested in pushing forward on the agenda that the Obama administration had in this area. But I hope that it's not as significant as it might be. In other words, because I obviously believe in the Obama administration's agenda on this issue. But there are other areas, too, where I sort of, you know, on NAFTA, there's a lot of threats about pulling out of NAFTA. It's unclear what's actually going to happen at this point. There's obviously a very shift in the agenda for trade. I think that is having an impact. The fact that we pulled back from TPP mm-hmm. has an enormous impact, in my view. I think it creates a gap in leadership in the Asia region and in a variety of other areas. And I think that's something that we're seeing in international law. When I look at the recent announcement that was made, for example, by Ambassador Haley in relation to the Global Compact for Migration, the fact that we withdrew from the conversation. So there isn't yet a global compact for migration. There's a conversation at the UN that's being engaged in. And the concept, at least as I perceive it, is really a sense of this is not a problem that any nation can solve on its own. We have over 65 million displaced persons around the world, well over 20 million refugees. You know, when you look at even the United States program on refugees, which is the largest program on refugees around the world, you know, even at the height of it in the Obama administration, we had committed to take 110,000. When you think about what that number is as compared to the global piece, you sort of realize you need your partners and allies to engage on this issue to really try to address the problem. And, you know, the reality is one of the ways you do that is through engaging in discussions like a global compact on migration. And if, you know, we're not in the room, we're not going to be able to shape what the answer is to that problem. And what Ambassador Haley said is that it was essentially incompatible, I think, with U.S. sovereignty. And I couldn't disagree more from the perspective of somebody who's worked in international law at the State Department.
Yeah, the major debate here is that the more we sign on to these agreements, one camp says, the more we sign on to the agreements, we give up sovereignty to a higher body. Is there actually a trade-off between sovereignty and international law?
Yeah, so this is sort of, you're exactly right, this is kind of the heart of the public debate, I think, on these issues. There's a view that treaties and international law somehow cede our sovereignty, right? Yeah. And I think, on the one hand, intellectually, you say if you enter into an agreement and you're agreeing to bind yourself in some way, then you could say intellectually that is, affects your sovereignty, right? Yeah. On the other hand, if you agree to bind yourself, you're exercising your sovereign right to do so, right? And if you do so in an agreement that's actually to your interest, to your benefit, and the other party is also agreeing to do certain things, then I think you can increase your sovereignty in a sense. The problem that I see, if you think about it as contracts, each of us in our society, right, enter into contracts. And the only time that we really have a concern about those contracts is when there's an unequal bargaining power between the individuals that are entering into the contract. And if the concern from the Trump administration is that the United States is weaker than every other country, then I could see that. But I certainly don't believe that to be the case, and it's hard to imagine that the Trump administration does.
But if we're stronger than every other country, then why do we need international law in the first place? Like, why couldn't we just do what we want to do? Isn't it Trump doesn't want to live under the law, he wants to live above the law. But isn't that just a better place to hang out? Because then you don't have to worry about the law. If you're above the law, then you break fewer laws, and isn't everybody happier?
Yeah. I mean... There's so many different ways to respond to that. I'm not sure that I want to accept the idea that as the strongest country, what we really need to do is bully every other country and just do what we want. But putting that aside for the moment, big companies, right, multinational corporations that are extremely powerful still enter into contracts, right? It's a way of organizing, in a sense, how it is that you're going to do your business and preparing for scenarios in advance of them occurring. And through international frameworks, we've been able to essentially exercise our power, but also ultimately advance our interests from a national security perspective, from a foreign policy perspective, from a values perspective. And when you think about a lot of treaties that we've joined, many of them are taking U.S. law, bringing them into the international realm, like the Disabilities Convention is a perfect example of this, where much of it is modeled on the American Disabilities Act. And we're essentially saying, these are the rules that we think make sense for the rest of the world, right? And when you have a treaty, you have an opportunity to say, these are rules we think do make sense. You have other countries that have an opportunity to participate in that conversation. And then once it goes into force, those other countries begin to accept that law into their own systems. That's a much more effective way.
It's in the long-term interest of the United States to do these sorts of things.
I think so.
I mean, how do you explain this to like a normal person? Are there treaties that they interact with every day?
Yeah.
How do you ground it in everyday life?
Yeah, I think about it. Every time you make a phone call, you send an email, you want to send a letter across the board, to somebody in another country, you're relying on treaty frameworks that have been joined by the United States, and many of them, frankly, were led by the United States. So, there's the UPU Convention is one of the oldest conventions out there, and it's the Universal Postal Union, I believe. But in any event, it essentially sets the rules for sending letters across borders, right? When you're an American business and you want to invest in a business in another country and you're making revenue there, essentially, you're going to get taxed by that other country. We have tax treaties that essentially provide that you don't have to get doubly taxed. So in other words, the revenue that you earn in another country, if it's taxed by that other country, you can deduct that from the taxes you would have to pay in the United States. There's so many places where every day people see the advantages of treaty. Get on a commercial flight, for example, and the standards for safety have been issued by ICAO.
It's the International Civil Aviation Organization.
Yeah, that was established in the Chicago Convention. So it's remarkable.
Are those types of contracts or international legal instruments different from things like global governance, like the UN? I mean, it seems to me intuitively different to say, okay, we'll have a trade agreement here, different from something like the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 that outlawed war. That seems more limiting in extent. I mean, it seems like there are some differences.
Yeah. I mean, the way I would say it is, You do have to judge every treaty on a case-by-case basis, right? You have to decide whether or not the compact before you is one that you want to enter into. And the United Nations is established by virtue of the UN Charter. The UN Charter is a treaty that we're a party to. So it's true that they're interconnected in many respects, but you may decide that not every international organization is something that you think is to the benefit of the United States. I have no problem with that. It's the idea that the tool itself is somehow a problem that's really a concern. And when you think about international organizations, just to give you a couple more examples. One of the reasons why I believe treaties are so important is because I don't think we can solve problems by ourselves, many of which are of critical importance to the United States. And an area that's maybe particularly obvious on this score is global pandemics, right? And when you think about the intelligence community indicated that essentially if you have an easily transmissible respiratory pathogen, essentially, and it can happen, it can appear anywhere in the world, right? And it affects, injures or kills essentially just 1% of the people it infects. Mm. Within 6 months, it's going to do so in every corner of the world, right? So we absolutely have to be on top of that type of thing occurring any place around the world. And when we dealt with Ebola, one of the international organizations that we relied on was the World Health Organization. Right. It's an old organization. It's established by treaty. It's something that we needed in that context. We're going to need those for other things, too. And that's a way of helping us to manage those problems before they end up on our shores.
Avril, it's 7 a.m., and we got a special treat today. they're fresh from the mall. Picked up by my girlfriend. Thank you, Valerie. Why Cheetos?
It's a little humiliating, to be honest, but I love crappy food.
I wouldn't call it crappy. I think they're delicious.
They're not exactly the healthiest snack. Let's just put it that way. But I don't like
they're cheese.
They're cheese, exactly.
High protein.
Yeah, exactly. Cheetos and Cheez-Its.
Cheez-Its. So you do like Cheez-Its. You don't discriminate between
Both of them I really feel,
So, I mean, there are all sorts of Cheez-Its. There are puffs. There are spicy or hot Cheetos, I think they're called, which are not warm. They're just spicy.
I go with your standard Cheetos.
Just the regular Cheetos.
Yes. On the Cheez-Its front, there are a lot of different Cheez-Its. I'm partial to the original, but I also do the white cheddar. So
really?
Yeah.
See, I don't know many people who enjoy the white cheddar. I always wondered who buys those.
Well, and they have the pecan. We used to, in the office have Cheez-It parties. So, there's a little bit of history.
You had Cheez-It parties?
Yeah, I don't think I can discuss that.
is that classified?
Yes, exactly.
Is it really? Okay.
It's at least embarrassing.
I have just one last question. You spent so much time as a government employee trying to be under the radar, and now you're out, and you are a fellow at Columbia University recently, this fall. Has that change been... You've got to totally shift gears. You've got to do things that are now media oriented, like be a guest on Snack Break. Was that a weird change for you?
Honestly, I'm still trying to stay to some extent under the radar. Basically, when it comes to universities or doing things that I think are important with certain NGOs and so on, it's a joy, frankly, for me. I learn from the people that I interact with, like you, and I like to be a part of that if I possibly can help in any way, and I think that's worthwhile.
Avril, thank you so much again for joining.
I really appreciate it.
This episode of Snack Break was produced with the help of the Hauser Digital Media Team, Tara Kavanaugh and Harris Passeltiner. Introduction music was composed by Evan Fennessy. To learn more about the show or watch episodes instead of listen to them, find us on YouTube or visit our website at snackbreakshow.com.